good Sunday for motorsport, that, boys.
Yeah, we had a lot to watch, didn't we? What with F1, MotoGP, the obvious ones, but yeah, GT World Challenge as well. IndyCar's going on as we speak.
Yeah, Pilar Rice in front.
Pilar Rice stealing my joke straight back. That's why he wanted to restart the podcast.
Don't tell them that. No.
Yeah, he wanted to restart so he could steal Alex Pilar Rice joke.
Well, it wasn't the first time someone stole a joke of mine today, is it, Jake?
Mate, I owned up to it.
How many likes on Twitter?
I don't know, not as many as I should have got.
I'm going to check. Because it's more than I would have got, so I want to take the credit for it.
Just jealous. But, so, yeah. Right, anyway, let's crack on with the F1
right,
talk.
The timer, we're going to do a bit different this week. We're going to start a timer for 20 minutes. Let's go. Where do we start? Start the race?
Yeah, well, that'll probably be a good way to start, to be honest with you.
Even on the formation lap.
That's true.
We had the clerk spinning off in the gravel on the formation lap.
Good way to start for him. Really fulfilled of confidence. But wet start, what did you think to it? I mean, Verstappen start using second gear, very, very clever. I didn't see the other people's dashes, but from what I saw, he was the only person starting in second near the front. And it seemed to really pay dividends. He had a little bit of a coming together with Lewis, who tried to hold it around the outside. Racing driver would have done and fed him off, because that's for sure what I'd have done. I think you two being racing riders, drivers, would have done exactly the same thing. And if not, then
I've definitely done the same thing there as well on lap one.
Everybody, any kind of racing driver knows or rider knows that's where you're heading. Mm. Yeah, even Hamilton would have known. You can see after the race. I mean, probably it's not in the front of their mind at that point, but they give each other a handshake, you know, good race. It's like no hard feelings. So it's what it is.
Exactly. It's all respect. And in the wet, you know, you've always got an excuse with the stewards, haven't you? Because, I just understood why I didn't hit him. Sorry.
Well, it's funny because when you watch his onboard again, Verstappen, it's like I heard on Sky commentary saying, oh, yeah, he's probably just got understeer. But you actually go back on board and he's on the throttle.
Yeah.
He's just pushing him wide.
Sorry.
Yeah, sorry, sir. I didn't really have any grip.
No, it's but the thing that like surprises me every time I watch F1 there now, I think they show a bit of like the archive footage before the weekend, but it's like the cars look so big there as well now, like with
and
the width of them. Yeah,
it's so fast, but shifting on around there. I saw a stat, and it's a different track configuration compared to when Jenson Button did the pole lap there, I think in 2004, and they were doing 19.4 or something, and quali was in the 14s, was it just something like that?
Yeah, I mean, they don't have that last chicane, do they?
No, not the little one, not anymore. Oh,
yeah. 5 seconds. I wonder whether I would give that.
Yeah, I'd reckon it'd be about with the chicane, it'd probably be like down to 2 seconds the gap.
But
the way they go over Pirotello and then down Acqua Minerale and then.
Well, I think it's the biggest percentage of acceleration on the calendar. So it's not like the average, it's not the highest average top speed, but it's the highest time they spend accelerating, something like that. Basically, it's all medium speed. So it's pretty impressive.
As me and Jay said in the preview to it, it's such a cool circuit. I'm really happy to see it back on the calendar, and I hope it stays.
You can see all weekend as well how much of a challenge it was to the drivers. I mean, you come from Bahrain where a mistake is, you know, you run off, you lose your lap, maybe even a spin, you just get going again. But even in free practice, you see Leclerc putting it in the wall. You can probably go down every single drive on the grid and say that they had a moment or binned it over the weekend.
That's how it should be, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That should exactly be like how that. It should be.
Yeah. Yeah, it should be really old school tracks, you know, like in the UK, you've got your Alton Parks. I mean, how many times have you been off at Alton Park? You may not have shunted, but definitely you've been wide. Mm. Whereas, you know, if you're driving at Paul Ricard, you can do what you want. And if you hit the wall, then you've had a real issue, you know.
It was nice to see other people spin apart from Mazepin, wasn't it? So, pretty interesting weekend. You two are too soft.
That's an open goal.
Too soft. Anyway, it was a good start to the race. The Hamilton Verstappen, and then it sort of started to be a bit of a cat and mouse game, didn't it? Especially between Hamilton and Verstappen. The gap came out and then came back in a bit and then in and out.
Yeah. I mean, he scampered off really quite fast, Verstappen, particularly on the first two or three laps. So it looked like the Red Bull actually switched its tyres on better, whether that was because of more load, simple more downforce, or that the pressures were different. You don't know because you're not part of the team. But he really seemed to get on top of it very fast. Also, I think Lewis may have been, I wouldn't say rattled, because he's a seven-time world champion. So I don't think he's going to be very rattled. But the little contact, you'd be checking for a front wing damage, which he had a little bit of. And then just getting back in the groove. But I think a standout driver for me at the start was Leclerc. Actually, he looked very, very good, made some decisive moves, as he always seems to do, and takes up that lead role kind of thing within Ferrari. And it was, super exciting start the whole way up and down the field.
Yeah,
it was interesting how I heard again in commentary being compared to Turkey with Hamilton's sort of pace as the tire wear came down and the track in the track dried. Because it was obvious Max had more pace at the beginning in the first sort of 10-15 laps, and as the track dried, he just sort of saw this gap start coming down, and it was like seconds even. So I don't know why that would be, why it seems to be that on two different occasions on two different tracks that when the intermediate tire starts to become a slick, why the Merc seems so, sure footed. It's a bit strange, but it's nice trait to have, I suppose.
Yeah, definitely. And also, I don't know because you don't know specific driving styles, but from the outside, Verstappen seems to really take the bull by its horns and rag the car, slide around a little bit more. Do you think that, I know Lewis is going to be on the limit of adhesion all the time, but maybe the way he brings in the tyre, so the first few laps of the stint was slightly kinder to the tyre surface, therefore when it does wear out, he has that little bit extra grip, or do you think it's just a car characteristic?
It's really hard to say, isn't it?
It's tough, yeah.
I mean, in Turkey, again, when there were, I remember Red Bull or Max specifically on the wet tyre, he was the only one that could make it work, if I remember that. And then when they went to the intermediates, I think it was that way around in qualifying, he had no chance. So I don't know. I don't know if it's something that's a car problem, if it's his thing. But maybe you could look at it and say, he switches them on quicker, and therefore he starts to suffer more towards the end of the stint. That might be a fair sort of assumption to make, but we just don't know, I suppose.
No, it was definitely, tricky conditions. We got our first safety car of the day with something that wasn't Nikita Mazepin's fault, actually, this time. But we had Nicholas Latifi run wide at the bottom of Acqua Minerale, and then he sort of... I think we all said it to each other at the time. He just didn't look, did he? He just kind of darted back onto the racing line, and... unfortunately, Nikita, he squeezed Nikita to the edge of the track and left him nowhere to go. And Nicholas ended up...
Turned around, didn't he? I mean, the thing is, I can understand how Nick has made that mistake or really wanted to get back on and get on with it, because he was in a half-decent position. You know, he had a fair few cars behind him, and the Williams has not been in that position recently or as of late. So, obviously, after making a little bit of a mistake there, you want to get on and get on with it. But maybe wasn't completely aware of his surroundings. And unfortunately, Maz has got caught up in a crash that wasn't his, and rightfully so. I think the commentary, again, was very good. And they took the blame off him, which was completely correct, as that was, in my opinion, Nick's fault.
I always like to see things like that in commentary. I know there are jokes being made about, but up and down the grid, these guys are trying their utmost. And I think you can see Nikita's trying to learn and improve all the time. But unfortunately, that does involve going over the limit to find that limit.
Yeah, but so controversially, I know, this will be a bit controversial, is the people that have a go at him have never driven a Formula One car and never driven a Formula One car that's difficult to drive, which the Haas is. If you go back to last year where you had Grosjean and Magnussen, who everyone rates really quite highly in junior Formula, they won a lot of races between them. GP2 championship for Roman, World Series Renault championship for Kev. they also had issues, and this car hasn't really been developed from last year to this year, so it's only going to be more difficult. So give the guy a bit of a break.
Also look back at Bahrain last weekend. Maz dropped it, but then who dropped it 2 seconds later? His teammate. And we saw
this not talked about.
No, exactly. And we saw the same again today with Mick unfortunately dropping it whilst doing what George was doing last year in the Williams, trying to warm his tyres up, get some temperature, and unfortunately sent it into the barrier.
Yeah, I was just gonna add to that before you did as well. Yeah, about Mick, he's had his fair share of moments as well, but I think it doesn't get talked about. I think because Maz has generally been making mistakes sort of more in practice sessions as well. Like his two moments in I think the FP1 on Friday, you know, especially last lap of the session, putting it in the wall at the last corner. Yeah. That's the sort of stuff that gets talked about more, a bit. You know, it gives you a sort of a stigma or whatever that stays with you a bit longer. But in the end, I think he's trying very hard to get on top of it quite quickly, maybe a bit too hard in the wrong time, wrong moment of the weekend. But yeah, I think that car is clearly quite difficult to drive, and I'm not gonna sit here and bash the pair of them.
No.
And there's definitely also two ways that people will go about building up to it. There'll be the guy that just goes out and absolutely tries to go above and beyond the limit and spins off and makes little mistakes. And then someone that will really slowly build up throughout the whole year, but be a lot slower or further off the pace at the start of the year, and then eventually get there. So, and there's always two different styles of driver. And obviously Maz is just trying to send it and get on with it, which is completely fair. You know, wants to prove himself in Formula One, take the car to levels that maybe it shouldn't be. But it's just costing him a little bit at the moment. He had about a day and a half in the car properly before the start of the season because the testing was, you know, short. So the thing, let's see in a bit.
The thing I like sort of compare it to as well is like, well, on the two-wheel side of things, I think the stat was last year, 2019, I think Marquez was had the highest crash rate, or, you know, had the most amount of crashes in the season. And it was like throughout all three classes, including Moto3, Moto2, because Marquez was crashing in practice all the time, trying to find that limit. Who bashes him for it?
Because it's a bit more, it's not accepted.
Normal though, isn't it?
It's a bit more expected probably on bikes, especially on the limit. But in the, you know, in Formula One, they it's just any general single seater and car racing, it's just not the done thing, you know. You shouldn't be just crashing left, right, and center all the time. But yeah, it's clearly sort of sink or swim kind of scenario at the moment for them, and I'm sure they'll get on top of it.
Exactly. And then so once the safety car had come in, we saw the Gasly train form.
That was a poor decision in hindsight, obviously. I mean, Ocon did the same thing, didn't he? Alpine, he started on the wet tyres. But they boxed early. They sort of decided to cut their losses, really. But yeah, that really, really cost Gasly. It didn't really help your prediction.
No.
Was your prediction, just to be clear, wasn't it?
No, it was your prediction.
My prediction you made for me.
Yeah, well, basically, this is what now happens if you're not here. We decided on a crap prediction for you.
Yeah, cheers, mate.
Nick's prediction was Gasly podium. My prediction was no Mercs on the podium, which almost came true.
Oh, I got the closest.
But you got the closest, Jake.
I had Verstappen, Hamilton, Leclerc podium, but I was one position off of that.
Yeah.
You went very safe, Sam, though, really, bar Leclerc, didn't you?
Yeah. Wow, I mean, that's I was nearly right. So
got to be in it to win it, I guess, isn't it?
Yes, exactly.
Exactly.
So, for me, the transition period, though, where it all started kicking off again after the Gasly debacle, was as usual when it's wet to slicks and the transition there. So Seb came in and tried to take a bit of a gamble and go early. Obviously, he struggled a little bit for those first two or three laps.
I was happy to see it. Really happy to see it, because I think it's what Seb need. You know, have fun. You're not.
You had nothing to lose.
You've got nothing to lose at the minute. Just go out there, send it, see what happens. And he did. And he was fastest man for a while. So good to see.
Yeah, yes. No mistakes. Went out the pits nicely, as in, didn't go off, didn't put it in the wall. Again, those conditions with almost 1,000 horsepower on full power, you know, to put one of those in the water is quite easy, particularly slicks in those conditions. So yeah, then we had, I think, out of the leaders, Lewis stayed out when Max pitted, and tried to do the overcut, as we call it. Had a slightly sticky front right tire, but I don't think that cost him too much. Max was well ahead by that point. And then that filtered down through the rest of the field, people finding their feet and trying to get, you know, further forward to the front. And my take of it was, you saw where the specialists before the switch, like Sainz, who is, his dad's a rally car driver and a very good one, someone that has been super impressive in the wet, was actually, I think he went off two or three times in a couple of laps, and came on the radio swearing at himself for making these mistakes. So it was super tricky out there on circuit, but for all the guys, that's for sure.
What do you guys, you know, it was, because when I watched the Hamilton Verstappen sort of pit stop time, I was really expecting, I thought, right, Lewis has got clear air. I think this overcut could work. What did you guys think as that was happening?
I actually thought Max had boxed about two laps too early at the time. It wasn't flashing. I mean, we don't have the data that the teams have, obviously, just watching on TV. But I didn't have the sector times in front of me, for example, of, let's say, Vettel, to sort of see what he was doing at the time. But you could see, you'd had a radio communication, I think, on the in-lap of Max, and he was basically sounded quite like argumentative about the idea of boxing this, you know, just at that moment. And it was a bit of a surprise to see him from the rear view camera shot turn right into the pit lane. And even, I think they played Hamilton's radio as well, and he sounded a bit surprised. I was the same. I was watching it, and my girlfriend, I said, oh, Hamilton's got the lead now. He'll come out in the lead. And I didn't even accounting for that sort of 1 second extra in the pit stop. I didn't think that would still be, I didn't think that would be a problem still.
No.
So I think it was clearly ready for slicks, you know, a bit earlier than people were anticipating, maybe.
Mm. Yeah, I think Seb's lap times were showing that for sure. But when they came back out on track, we saw this big group of traffic that had formed, and Verstappen, we saw the gap between Hamilton and Verstappen close as Verstappen got to the back of it. He got through them quite quickly, but Hamilton didn't. He tried to slide up the inside of, I think it was an Alfa Romeo.
Russell.
Was it Russell?
He
had a busy lap, didn't he?
Yeah. It was the same lap.
It was. So he went up the inside, and it was difficult because George is, again, wasn't to blame at all for that. Lewis went down the inside when it was a completely wet line, and only, I think it was wheel track in that corner. And it slipped at the best of times. And obviously turned in and just lost the rear. And then you've got to overcorrect, and by that time he's in the gravel. What I really thought was cool and the very showing of his maturity and calmness was the way he reversed so slowly to not dig into the gravel with the rear wheels, and then continued to reverse the whole way out instead of trying to get it back in first. So once he got the momentum up, just did the whole pirouette and then cracked on. A lot of lesser drivers would have, actually, I think, got stuck by either being panicky and tried to really release the clutch too fast, or tried to get it back in first afterwards and done that.
It was so unlucky, though, I thought, especially when you go on board of him. It was like, George didn't do anything wrong. It was blue flags. But when you go on board of Hamilton, he had no choice but to go to the inside. He maybe didn't even want to. He wanted to probably wait till after the corner up the straight and just go past with a lift, with George lifting. But you go on board of him and he's taking it so steady. He's like, he's so slow, and it's still just nothing. So
it was
unfortunate.
It was just slow motion, wasn't it, as it went off?
Yeah, it was like on a downshift almost or something. Maybe he's gone fourth to third or something. And it's like as he went down, even though it was really late, so it should be all fine. It was like on the downshift and a massive oversteer. Yeah, see you later, mate. Yeah,
complete nightmare. And I didn't expect him to knock his front wing off, though. I thought he was going to get it spun up enough just to avoid the barrier, but...
He tried that, didn't he? But
tried, but then you go kind of straight forwards and gravel because obviously you don't get the purchase to keep the car enough sideways. And he was, I think the front wheels by that time were already on the concrete.
So then they were
more difficult.
So then less than a lap later, George gets involved again.
Oh, the big talking point of the day.
It was a nasty one, though, wasn't it, boys? I mean, I thought for a while there could be a few, tears after that one, because you don't like to see it. I mean, if you're doing, 320, 330 Ks an hour, basically 200 miles an hour, if you hit a wall, it's going to hurt. So I was happy to see them both walk out revved up, but okay.
I think it, again, shows the importance of the halo. Had a huge role to play, because as Russell's car kicked into Valtteri's, the front, was it the front left or front right? I purchased up onto the halo. So that protects Valtteri. So another win for the halo, which is good to see. But yeah, it was... we've had a little bit of a discussion at the time about this, and we've had a little discussion before we've, whilst we're just messing about before. And I think the words 60-40 came out of Nick's mouth. So I'll let him start.
It actually came out of Jake's mouth, but we disagree on.
Which way came out of both of you. So fight your corners. Go on, Nick.
Yeah. So, I mean, I know George, I've worked with him. I think he's a brilliant driver. I've raced with Valtteri as well. So they're both very good. In my opinion on this one, it was 60 on George and 40 on Valtteri. Obviously, Jake thinks different and everyone's entitled to their own opinion. I must say, though, that it's a complete racing incident at the end of the day. Yeah. So you could split it 50-50 and I'd be completely fine. But as we were talking off air, if I had to do a 60-40 split, it would have been, the way that I said. So slightly more on George.
Why is that?
Because I feel that I understand you've got to prove yourself and you want that seat. But are you going to beat a Mercedes car as it's drying out at the end of the race in a Williams? The answer is probably not. So could there be a peace of mind or a thought where I just thought, it's a Mercedes, I'll leave it for this one or not? I get it. I'm a racing driver too. I would have damn sure wanted to get by. But, and hindsight, sorry, is a wonderful thing, but it's just, so difficult to call.
And go on, Jake.
I mean, it's definitely a racing incident. I don't know if they've given any penalties or whatever, but I hope they haven't.
No, they haven't.
I think they classed it as a racing incident.
Yeah, exactly. And I sort of think, I'm trying to put myself in the mindset of the drivers at that moment, not thinking about what comes afterwards or what might come later in the race, depending on, having the benefit of hindsight like we do now. And if I'm sitting there in George's car with DRS and Bottas has clearly been struggling the whole race and he's not exactly lighting the world up. I know he's just come out of the pits not that long ago. But if I'm sitting there in DRS and I've basically on his gearbox at pit exit and there's a gap to the right, I go for it. I don't know. I just think it's if I was being expected to lift at that point there, just because the car's probably going to come past me again in 3 or 4 laps time or whatever, I feel like I might be sitting there thinking I bottled that a little bit. I don't know.
It's where my endurance mindset comes in. I think having had the experience more of trying to survive the 24-hour races, not just I've got an hour and a half kind of thing, maybe switches my mindset more towards the other way.
Oh, I absolutely agree. That's an endurance race. And if that Formula One race is going on for another 5 hours, it's like, well, what's the point, in taking this risk? You just try and follow him and stay in his DRS and get towed along. But yeah, I think you never know what was going to happen. There's already halfway through the race. George could have sided off. We don't know. But I think Bottas just moves to the right a little bit. He does leave him a car width just about, but he wouldn't have been catering in the mindset, that there is a damp patch right next to the white line.
No. And equally, he wouldn't have wanted to go on the damp patch because there was, it wasn't a full track width anyway, because there was one and a half car with maybe a little bit more. But Bottas did not want to stay more to the left than he had to, because then his left-hand tyres for braking would have been on the inside. And I think the only person that did a fantastic overtake like that was Lewis, and he is masterful on the brakes in there, and he's the only one that pulled it off early into the slick running when it was still pretty sketchy at that point. And he pulled it off brilliantly, and he's the only one to do it.
You also see from Kimi's on board from behind as well, that just before the car snaps on George, Bottas actually goes back to the left a little bit, so you know that he's not trying to do anything malicious. He's just, you know, he's in his mirror. The car's, he's in the mindset of, you know, I'm in the faster car, I'm on slicks, so I'm still warming them up. I just need to keep that car behind me because I'll start off from him in a second. And I'll go to the right until I can't go anymore. But he's obviously, and why would you, I suppose, be catering for that little sliver of damp patch that George ended up getting his rear tire onto with the rear wing wide open.
Exactly, particularly when you're doing 200 miles an hour, you're not thinking, oh yeah, well, I don't want to put him on the little wet patch over there. Exactly. You're just trying to concentrate on keeping the car on track, particularly on those first few laps when you're getting used to everything.
I think what didn't help as well is what the Imola home straight is...
It's not straight.
No, it's not straight, but what
Imola
happens...
bent straight.
Basically, as they go round, Jay will know as he's raced there as well, but you've got an inside curb just on the inside there as you go through the kink and as you go into Tamburello. And basically Bottas is on the inside, and as it's just kinked in the track, Bottas hasn't really reacted to the kink as you normally do, and he's just kind of like, I think he's just dipped straight to sort
that
of
gives you like, sensation that he's gone right.
Yeah, I think it gives you more, it gives you more of the sensation he's swerved right. But I think then George has also gone to the right of him thinking he'll stay more left. And then the doors shut very quickly for George because Valtteri's just sat in the middle. And then Valtteri's gone, oh, there's a car on my right. Back to the left. And then it's all come together.
By that point, it's too late. And as we, well, as you boys know, when you're doing 200 miles an hour, things happen bloody fast. Yeah. And once it's gone, it's gone. So unfortunately, they were both passengers. And that was all she wrote.
I'm gonna sit between you two, and I'm just gonna go pure racing instant. But the thing is, I think Ted Kravitz said in the commentary as well, you've got to respect this place and that corner especially.
You've ridden there, Jake. You've driven there. I've driven there. I find into that corner so difficult to actually put a pass on anywhere because it feels like, I don't know about you, but it feels so
narrow.
Quite wide, and then it goes really narrow just before you get to that place where you're thinking about braking. Obviously in a GT car you're braking a lot earlier than those boys, but still it's very, very difficult. So the guys doing overtaking moves into there during those conditions were quite special.
I always find it really difficult to put an actual braking point on in there as well. Yeah, it's a surreal piece of track. It really is. Because as you said, Nick, it just goes from this big, like, wide open to all of a sudden, it's literally one and a half F1 cars wide. What's happened here?
You could also, I suppose we should also touch on the reaction from George little bit. I mean, he's completely, hyped up.
Adrenaline just, through the roof.
Massive adrenaline you can see in him, but and who am I to talk about that? but we've all done it. But I think he'll go to sleep tonight thinking he probably should have just walked behind the barrier and not, and just took a minute, because going over to a car with a driver in that was just hit the wall at, you know, like yourself at, you know, nearly 200 mile an hour and then not even going there just to check that he's not injured but actually having an argument with him. Is proper red mist, and it doesn't always look great.
Well, that's what I thought he was doing, though. I thought he was going to go, oh, you're right. Then it was a tussle, and then Bottas flipped in the old bird or whatever. So I thought it was quite funny then, because clearly you're feeling all right if you're able to do that. And was very glad, like I said at the start of the topic, that they both walked away without too many issues.
I think but flip side of that for me, I think it's great to see a bit of passion. I really do.
In hindsight, it's great because they're not injured. I'm just thinking,
at that very moment.
When George is going over and he's about to peer into the cockpit, he doesn't know if he's all right or not. So it's not the best thing to do, probably. But
crap swing, though, wasn't it? Like, it didn't actually hit him, really.
Yeah, it wasn't a proper punch.
Poor effort.
Proper punching nowadays in Formula One. Maybe only Verstappen I could see doing that.
Brazil. Actually,
we'll do that another day. We'll have a segment. Who's most likely to have a good old scrap with someone?
It's already settled. It's only Verstappen, isn't it?
Yeah, so. Definitely Verstappen.
But after that huge shunt, anyway, we had red flag. Bit of a wait for all the boys and drivers trying to reset, and saw Lewis take himself away, reset after the little mistake, which was obviously the lap beforehand. And then we started racing again.
Lucky Hamilton.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, you have to have some luck.
Bottas changed his front wing as well.
Yeah, all in one. And did they reset his place slightly?
Yeah, they did the thing where the cars from, I think it was like Stroll downwards, went out and then back round, and then they all went.
They got to one lap themselves, effectively.
Yeah.
So they were, super fortunate in that sense, but it made for a great race as well for him to come through the pack a little bit afterwards.
Yeah, I think it was, I think it added some drama to the end of the race. But the thing I was really happy to see from all of that was how close Carlos was to Charles in the Ferraris. It was really good to see the two Ferrari boys and how much that Ferrari's come on for this season to be actually, he's defending from the Mercedes for one, but two, they're actually all in the top five. And that the Ferraris are actually keeping with the McLaren and the Mercedes not absolutely walking off into the distance.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm looking at the time results in front of me as well. And I think the Ferraris had a good day. Obviously, Norris had a very good day. I'm just looking at in P6, Daniel Ricciardo is 24 seconds behind Sainz in P5. That's a bit of a... Let me just check that's right, because that doesn't sound right, but it is.
It does sound right.
That just isn't... I get he's getting used to the new car.
It's not Ricciardo-esque, though, is it?
It's not, is it? And Sainz is in the same situation, and he's, he's not exactly... I don't think he's quite on Leclerc's pace yet, but he's doing exactly what you would expect him to be doing at least a minimum. But Daniel's going to be,
And your teammates on the podium.
Yeah.
Not really an excuse.
You could use it the flip side, because I think some people were a bit underwhelmed or maybe questioning the quality of Norris.
Mm.
Now you've put him against a veteran and a Grand Prix race winner. Maybe you're seeing the emergence of a new British star to take over from Lewis once Lewis retires in however many years he wants. Because for me, Lando this year has showed a great amount of good character, speed, and composure, and really learned from his previous season with McLaren. I think that's really showing. So he's actually leading the team from the front. His quali lap, I know, he was annoyed with that he dropped the wheel in turn six or seven and got track limits. But watching that lap on board, it was really quite a special lap. So I think, it's one to watch for sure.
Yeah, exactly. And, rounded off the podium quite nicely. I definitely think he was the deserving driver of the day in third place. So good things to come from McLaren. I think, to be honest, we're only two races into the season. And I think Ricciardo's got to be quite pleased with how they've gone. But as you said about I think both the McLaren drivers from last season, I'm talking about Norris and Sainz, I think they've both been a bit underrated.
I touched on it, didn't I, in the preview that I think, because a lot of people, when Ricciardo comes into McLaren, a lot of people had the opinion that it was a sort of step up, the sort of gained effectively, gained with Sainz and into Ricciardo. But I kind of didn't see it that way. I really think Carlos is underrated. He's the only him and Ricciardo himself, but Sainz didn't exactly get smashed by Verstappen in Toro Rosso. He gave him a proper run for his money. I know it was his rookie year. Verstappen, but I really do rate Carlos quite well, and I thought he was going to give Leclerc a lot of hard times this year. Maybe not as hard as I expected this early though.
No,
but yeah, he's going to have a good year. It looks like, I think, as long as he keeps on his trajectory, because he'll only improve.
Yeah, and he'll get used to that pressure, because you see it with even Alonso folded a little bit under the Ferrari pressure from that big corporate. You are a Ferrari driver, I'm sure it's very, very different to driving with your smaller teams, albeit McLaren's a smaller team, but it's very family orientated and maybe not quite as cutthroat. Yeah. I think you see the guys in Ferrari when the big pressure's on, you either sink or swim. And for me, he's got that attitude. And I think he's also got that background, because he's been in the spotlight because of his dad since he was a really young kid. So it'll be nothing new to him. So I think he'll really thrive. And you'll just see him get better and better, like you say, throughout the season.
I think also Carlos seems like one of those types of people. He seems like one of those people who can, he almost likes that sort of corporate, quite structured sort of entity that Ferrari is. I think, you know, with the early reports where he's been in the factory every day, he's been talking to everybody, he's been learning about the team. And I think he quite enjoys the fact that, okay, there is pressure here, but everything's done out to do a great job. So I think he's going to settle in really well. He was less than 2 seconds behind Leclerc at the lap at the flag.
Yeah, and looked really strong actually in the dry conditions. I mean, in the wet, Leclerc was quite amazing, I think, at the start, and got on top of it well. Mm. But also you have to remember that'll be the first time that Carlos has probably driven the car in the wet.
Yeah.
So it's or that style of car in the wet. But in the dry, I think he actually looked a bit faster than Leclerc, which is saying something, being only two races.
And Bahrain as well, it looked like that until Q3.
Yep. Yeah.
No, but I think just as a Formula One fan, I think we're in for a treat this year. Yeah. I think we're in for the tightest championship in a long time, with obviously Red Bull and Mercedes. But I think even, you know, the third, fourth and the fifth battle, I'm quite looking forward to as well. I mean, it looks like McLaren, Ferrari and AlphaTauri have that sort of, you know, top end of the midfield. They've kind of split the midfield in half, really. And that's going to be quite impressive to see who sort of sneaks those podiums like Norris did this weekend.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it will be difficult for the other teams to actually make a headway as well, because what you've got to think is there's a huge rule change for next year in 2022, and people will start to switch their focus onto that car quite early on, and the teams with slightly lesser budgets will do that earlier than the ones that can run two simultaneous programs.
I was just going to say,
that's already done it.
They've already done it, yeah. Before the season basically started, they've got last year's car. So I think, not exactly where they are now is where they'll finish, but you're not going to see a huge development race. I think they'll cut off at a certain point and really start focusing on next year's car, as this year's car is almost a continuation from last year. So there's not so much more they can do. Whereas next year, I think when I was at Aston a couple of weeks ago, we were saying in the region, it could be, I don't know exactly, but between 12 and 18% load reduction in terms of downforce. So you imagine how much slower these cars are going to be through corner, but also how much more difficult to drive, which is good because I think we'll see more mistakes made, which is, again, good, better racing. You'll be able to follow closer. All very interesting stuff coming up over the next 18 months, 2 years.
Yeah, 100%. And we're just gonna do your boys. Who are your winners of the day and losers of the day? Start with losers.
Losers. My top loser. it's not the nicest way to say it. Is it top loser? Probably Bottas. I think he started. He topped both of the sessions on Friday, and he just sounded so positive in the media as well. And you know, I think it's typical sort of, you know, Hamilton to sort of put him on pressure through Saturday, and then you sort of see sometimes these weekends from Bottas where he seems to just not, you know, find himself a bit further back. And in Q3, made mistakes, having on both laps, ended up in eighth place or something like that on the grid. Can't, you know, on the wet track to begin with, can't do anything, can't come through the field like I feel Hamilton would have done, and then ends up in a big crash. So he's already on the back foot, you know, and that's only going to intensify naturally with his contract up as it normally is every year at the moment.
And for me, it would actually be Perez, because obviously he started second and ended up not being in the points. Actually, the first stint, he looked quite good. Again, it'd be the first time he's driven that car in the wet. Very, very tricky car by the sounds of it from previous drivers watching those previous drivers. It seems when difficult conditions come about, wet, dry or very high deg, Max is the only person that seemingly gets the most out of it and doesn't really make so many mistakes. So for me, it would be him. Obviously, he'll be disappointed about it, but he can take also the positives from Saturday. It's not every day you're going to beat Max Verstappen in qualifying. Right. So I think that's a great step forward for him. And he will come good in the race 100% because that's where he's actually tends to be better.
Yeah. And I was going to go with, I've already mentioned him from Bahrain, but I think if Yuki had kept it within those dry lines after the safety car, it would have been really interesting to see what he could have done.
Well, I swear when he spun into the gravel at turn two, he'd just overtaken Hamilton on the restart. I swear he did. Because when I watched the replay back, it looked, because he was close going down to the field. I might be wrong, but he just...
It was Kimo and Aston, wasn't it? Because they're similar-ish.
Yeah, he'd just overtaken somebody, I'm pretty sure, into that corner and then immediately spun. I could be talking absolute rubbish, but it kind of looked like that from the helicopter shot.
I always just have the replay, the... Ooh, you might be right, Jake.
Eagle-eyed Jake.
He did.
He just overtook Hamilton on the restart into turn two.
He just sent it down the inside of Hamilton.
My man isn't scared, is he? Good lad.
And then immediately spun. That's typical Yuki.
Yeah. Win it or bin it mentality, which is what you've got to have as a young aspiring F1 driver trying to prove your points. So
like, 7-time world champion.
And starting from the back of the grid, qualifying was just a mistake, nothing more. Rookie pushing on, that's fine. But if he had just held that, it would have been like ahead of Hamilton. Yeah, that could have been
not for long. But I think it would have been very interesting. And again, I can't reiterate how impressive Hamilton was coming through the field today.
Incredible.
Didn't put foot wrong, and those it was clinical. It was like watching a chess match. It was very impressive.
Yeah.
So I'm going to take your winner for the day was probably Hamilton, Nick.
Yeah, I mean, Verstappen was awesome. And he always tends to be when it's mixed conditions. You see him every time he comes to the forefront. I mean, we didn't talk about... He basically spun behind the safety car before the restart.
You know?
And then he composes himself and just... I think he pulled something crazy like 3 or 4 seconds in 2 laps.
Mm.
And it's just that natural flair and talent that, 9 times out of 10, you wouldn't have caught that, but he did catch it behind the safety car, composed himself and went away. If I had to choose one guy, yes, Hamilton, just because of the clinical overtakes.
And Jake?
Norris.
Yeah.
I think he's 6th on the grid or something like that, maybe 7th. Go to 3rd, up to 2nd for a long time. I was challenging Max a little bit on the restart. I'll be on the softer tyre, but I think he's got a strong car as well with that new Mercedes engine this year as well. So I think he'll get a fair few more trophies this year.
I don't like to go with people on the podium for this sort of thing. So I'm going to say someone a bit left field. I'm going to go with Carlos Sainz because I think to be finishing less than 2 seconds behind your teammate who knows that car and has shown how good he is in the past, I think that's a quality day. And considering he's made so many mistakes, and he was absolutely kicking himself on the radio, but he composed himself and sort of said, yeah, it's all right now.
Yeah.
Get your head down, get it done. But I think a brilliant F1 race. And if there's more like that this year, we'll have plenty to talk about. And our 20 minute timer has gone completely out the window.
Yeah, well, we are now. Plenty time.
42 minutes. So
there's too much to talk about. That's the problem.
You've got only a bit of editing to do.
To cut that down to 10 20 minutes, that's not happening. Well, that's what me and Jake found out with the last one. We were sat there just waffling.
There's
on
so much to talk about.
Yeah, it is brilliant to be able to have a good chat about it, but I mean, let's move on to MotoGP because
thank God.
Number one, Alex, I know you want to talk about it, and number two, if I am to watch one or the other, I would choose MotoGP every day because I just think number one, completely lunatics, number two, there is always action, no matter what. So you always have a race like we did in F1 in Imola, but you have it every time out. And there's so many more people that can win a race or do quite extraordinary things time they go out. So let's start with who was your top pick just from the race, straight out the box. Who was your top pick?
You can be a real Sunday man in MotoGP. I can't remember who I said now. Who did I say? I think I said Miguel Oliveira was going to go well this year, this weekend again. But then I did say...
Yeah, didn't he? He went off.
But then I did say the KTMs are going to struggle with the front tyre again, and they did. Yeah. And I think I said Fabio was going to go well, and he did.
Ta-da. Yeah.
Ta-da. So,
Jake, did you say someone?
I think I said Rins on the podium, and that went well. I think I said Miller It was one Ducati, I think. Oh,
yeah. It went off at turn two, turn three, quite early on.
Turn three. It was a really weird crash, actually. It was literally just as you come out of two with lean angle, and as he touched the brakes to sit it up, it kind of just the front kind of folded, and then the back went round. So it was kind of a bit of an all-in-one crash.
Well, at least you talked about it, but I didn't say that. I said Martin. Jorge Martin. I
know it didn't go well, did it?
But he had a monster shunt, didn't he, on Saturday?
In FP3, he ragdolled it a bit. He flew back to Barcelona, I think this afternoon. So at least had some surgery.
Yeah,
so hopefully he'll be back in Jerez. But
particularly after his run in, was it Qatar, when he was leading the race for a long time? Yeah, after awesome pole.
Third place, it was brilliant ride. But I think it was an interesting weekend for GP. We'll start with the qualifying, and track limits were the talk of the day, and infringements and yellow flags. And
there were some big losses, weren't there?
Yeah, so Francesco Bagnaia put it on pole, but then Miguel Oliveira had a crash moments before that, and that had put the yellow flag before the caution down. And the rule in MotoGP now is if you've got a yellow flag, that invalidates anybody's lap time going through that sector. So, and it was down the hill into the Craig Jones corner, which is you come over the first big crest and you go down into the hill, up the left and up onto the top there. And the basically Miguel had crashed at 8 at Craig Jones, and then the LED caution board and the flag are on the right. But the problem is you're coming over there on a MotoGP bike, which is wheeling and bucking, and you're looking left to look up through the corner, and he just basically hadn't seen it at all. And a lot of the riders came out in the media, Italian media, and I even heard a few interviews saying, like, it's not his fault, you know. Yeah. There is no way you can see that. And then Neil Hodgson and Gavin Emmett in commentary today were saying about it. And Neil said a very good point, that Gav said, oh, what if you put the board on the inside? And Neil said, no MotoGP rider is going to roll out of it, out of a qualifying lap, because of the chance you might have gone, oh, it wasn't, you know, it was just a glimpse of the sun off the board. Or you think you've seen a yellow flag and you haven't. So I think there's a bit of board placement, but it was unlucky for Francesco. And he was back on 11th on the grid. But the other man who was very unlucky as well was Maverick Vinales. Did you see this, Nick, with the green?
It was turn four, right, on the exit of the brow.
Yeah. He literally, it's very, you guys know it in the car as well. If you go off the curb and onto the green or onto the grass or whatever, you feel through the tyre and through the wheel, you feel that movement of different surfaces. And on the bike, it's exactly the same. You feel this, like, you feel the judder of the curb. But then if you go over it, you feel the drop of the curb. And basically, Maverick's come out of turn four and literally, I mean, millimeters touched the green. And they've got sensors now that sense the bike's going off the curb onto the green. And it was millimeters, absolute millimeters. You wouldn't have felt it on the bike. The TV cameras barely picked it up, but that got his lap cancelled as well. So they were starting, I think they were starting 11th and 12th on the grid. And that was the big talking point of Saturday, because it gifted Quartararo the pole position.
Yeah, which is awesome. But I mean, for me, I subscribed. I'm out here in Germany, and I didn't have any access to MotoGP. So I've subscribed for the year just simply because I wanted to see the return of the Mac or Marc Marquez. And that was the huge thing for me. So I watched FP1, FP2, just to see, you know, the first few laps. And for me, and you'll have to explain how the hell he does stuff like this or try, Alex, but, you know, I think it was two or three laps in free practice one, mixed conditions, because it had been raining overnight, and he puts it fastest. Not everyone's done a full run or whatever, but he was clear by 2 seconds or something, and it's just like he'd never been away.
Marquez doing Marquez things, wasn't it? It was great. But was it a moment in FP2 he had where he's come over
Seven.
And he's got it on full opposite lock as it's, so you come over a little brow there and it's fully off throttle and he's just kicked the rear out.
It's
a big moment when someone who doesn't even understand what is a moment and what isn't on a bike or looks at it and goes, oh
yeah,
like jumps back into the seat as if to say that was nearly hospital.
Everybody just kind of went, oh, Marquez is back.
And fully on it. I mean, you could see he got more and more comfortable. I think it was in FP2 because FP1, he was still very neat and not the normal flamboyant Marquez. Although still fast and faster than Paulo Espargaró, I think, from what I remember, even FP1. Yeah. But then in FP2, you could see him trying to chase it, trying to, you know, get that bike feel back and get used to the whole setup, because he won't have done any testing with this bike, and Stefan Bradl's been on it developing it for Bradl, not for Marquez.
Credit to Stefan Bradl though, absolute full credit to him. You know, I know Paul's struggling and Paul will get there in a couple of races. He just needs to unlock it and he will, because he's an absolute grafter. But yeah, credit to Stefan Bradl, because you know the job he's done to help continue the development of that motorcycle, to give Mark a bike he can just jump on. And it'll be like, oh, it's actually, you know, rideable and we can do something.
Yeah, but has he ever not done that? Even when the bike is just like an absolute, you know, rubbish.
Special human being he is. I know 100%. Listening into all the commentary, when he's debriefing and you can really see, even after that first run, he was like, oh, maybe we need to change X, Y, Z. And you can just see it's like, this isn't quite to my liking. Can we change this? And he's taking it more away from what Bradl's style is, although, like you say, it's a good base towards him. And to be able to, I know I'm skipping forward a little bit, but to be able to hold on for the whole race and manage it like he did. And, you know, he was so calm and knew his place and just thought, right, let me get the laps under my belt. It was very impressive.
It was, you know, the last thing he needed to do was crash, and he didn't. And I know that sounds like such an understatement when people say, oh, you just don't need to crash. You know, that it's not the... Take it from me. It's not that easy, but you could see he was up for the fight. And when you're fighting, it's especially hard to make a little mistake, like we saw in the F1 this weekend. And I think it was a couple of laps in. Who did he tag the back of into like turn three?
It was Rins.
Yeah, they got into the hairpin. And he tagged the back of someone, and I'm just thinking, oh my god, this, you know, Mark's back. But this is the last thing he doesn't need to throw himself. He doesn't need to have an awkward crash, throw himself over the bar, jam his shoulder, and you know, do something horrible. But I think that kind of happened, and I do think that settled him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he kind of went, right, okay, that was just maybe not. Let's just back it down a bit. But no, absolutely superhuman effort. He suffered today. He properly suffered, because that is the most physical track you can go to. You've got undulation, you've got big high G-force change of directions there. Super physical track, and absolutely superhuman effort. And I'm glad to see him back.
He looked really emotional, not from pain. Yes, he was in discomfort, but that he just finished the race, he'd actually be able to get back on his baby, ride the horse, you know, and do a whole stint, with his team. And he was actually, you know, he was really quite emotional, which was lovely to see.
I think there was a lot of concern over that injury. I think I think everyone knows it's a big injury, but I don't think anybody knows properly how big that injury was. Because I remember watching the crash back, and you see his arm go in a direction your arm should never go in. And I think it was kind of thinking, oh, I'll be a couple of weeks, you know. Well, we saw him get back on the bike a week later.
Yeah, it wasn't even a week later.
It wasn't even a week later. He shouldn't have done it. But we saw him get back on it. And I think it was that kind of opinion of, oh, we'll just fix it up and it'll be absolutely fine. But I think the extent of it was massive. And it was a massive... I think it could have questioned his future career at times. And I think what we saw after the race was just him going, well, yeah, we're back. And
that's an achievement. Can you imagine the message that sends out mentally to the rest of the paddock?
Scary.
Well, it buggers you, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it's just
he was even messing with them though, wasn't he? I don't know if you saw it, Joe, but like in quali, he was going out and he found the championship winner from last year, Mir, and was just trying to toy with him, and then he'd find someone else and trying to toy with him. Although he knew maybe physically he couldn't keep up, he was just planting that little seed, like, you just wait, mate, because I'm coming for you. And it's brilliant.
Imagine how demoralizing that is, you know. Where did he? Who was imagine finishing behind him and thinking that bloke has one arm.
Well,
it's his brother, wasn't it? He beat his brother.
Imagine he hasn't rode this bike for 9 months and he's basically got one arm.
Nakagami is on a similar bike, isn't he?
Yeah, but Nakagami that brings us quite nicely onto him. He had an absolute monster going into turn one. Yeah. He was on the deck at about 260, 270 kilometers an hour.
Down the hill as well, wasn't it? Down the braking bit.
Yeah. So he touched the brakes at the top and it completely went on him, and he was properly battered. And that was another superhuman effort for him to finish, because I don't know if you saw warm up at all. He came in from warm up and they had his levers stripped out and they were like poking it, you know, poking around to see where he is. And he just looked absolutely ruined. So
the doctor came as well, didn't they? And they were injecting him mid-session to give him like painkillers, literally with a needle in the back of the garage. And then he got up, he's like, all right, okay, get back on. Nuts.
To do the race, so a superhuman effort from him as well. So I'd really
you just don't get this in a car. When you lock up, you just don't break a bone.
No.
It just happens. You lock up and you're in hospital.
You're going to have a big one, aren't you, by the looks of it? You know, you can maybe walk away and limping.
Yeah.
But if it's a really big one,
I think the thing is that Portimao, it doesn't look that fast in places, but it really, in the places it doesn't look fast, it really is fast still. Like, just before you, where was Martin's crash at? Was it like 7? I think it was at 7 or something.
Yeah, yeah, where old mate had his almost off, where Marcus had his almost off.
Yeah, but that little section, it doesn't actually look too quick on the TV, but that is properly quick, all of that. Yeah. And you don't really feel it. And like, look at Oliveira's one at the bottom, and he absolutely went miles. So, yeah, Portimao, scary track, fast track, brilliant track. It scraped some racing, but the king of it was Quartararo. And
I was just going to say,
what a race from him.
Yeah, what a race. Yamaha looked strong.
Mm. Yeah, it looked like we spoke about it a bit earlier, but he's really come of age this year. So for people that didn't see the race, he dropped back off pole, I think, to 6th or 7th. And he didn't get erratic then. He just got into his rhythm, picked them off one by one, got to the front, then was back under pressure by, I think it was Rins. And those two, to be fair to them, they did just leave the rest of the field. They maybe had 4 or 5 second gap to the guys behind.
And
it was quali lap after quali lap after quali lap until one of them broke. And
they were only half a second pretty much off quali pace until Alex, not even a mistake. That's the thing. It wasn't
just trying
even
to stay with him, wasn't it? It was just a little slip up.
He was just laying it on the line. And that's what happens sometimes. And full credit to him. I think that was, for me, that's one of Alex's stronger races, because he was, you know, he was gapping his teammate behind, but maybe his teammate had that just little bit of world championship experience and sort of going, right, this is a bit too quick. We're not going to last there. But Alex laid it on the line, and quality ride.
He wanted to win, didn't he?
He's got nothing to be ashamed of. I think it's one of those situations where you know, you'd be sat in the pit lane and you go, yeah, fair enough. Asked a bit much, but oh well. And another man who asked a bit much was Johann Zarco.
Well, he got into the lead, didn't he, in turn one?
He did in turn one. Then I don't think he had the greatest race pace. That Ducati still looks a bit difficult for him mid corner. He's come out of eight and hit the brakes at the top, and it sort of gave a warning, bigger warning. Now you're on the floor. Just asked for a bit too much towards the end.
It was a very different, because Rossi had one there as well. And what I'd like to know is, what was the difference? Because Rossi's just, it hardly looked like he put any lean angle in, and he was already on the floor. So why would that happen?
You come over the lip there, and as you come over the lip, it, you know, the whole bike goes light. So it's quite easy to get, so for Zarco's, it's quite easy to get that rear end movement, because you're trying to turn, you're coming out of the left and you're coming over the right and you're hitting the brakes and you're still trying to turn into the coming right. So you're trying to get the bike sat up, but you've also got this unweighting of the rear suspension and you've got all these variables coming into play. And Zarco's has just gone a little bit light on the rear and it's bobbed. And unfortunately if you picked it up slightly and just ran on a bit deep, you could control that bob, but you were never going to pull it down to the apex. And unfortunately he may have just sat up at that moment, but it tucked. So six of one, half than the other, really. It's just unfortunate, sort of like late race thing, you know, you've got a bit more spin on the tire, a little bit less on the front, and you go in there one lap and it's okay, and you go in there the next and it's not. So unfortunately, so for Zarco.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that it looks like one of the most difficult circuits to ride a MotoGP bike on anyway, because people were throwing it down the road quite often, 100%. Even from the start of FP1. So, I mean, Quartararo to do the job he did was fantastic. And in stark contrast to his teammate, Vinales. So what was up there? You know, he never made headway.
So Mav decided to go for the harder rear tire on the grid. And it just really didn't work. I saw an Instagram post and he basically just said, we don't understand. But from the outside, we've seen Maverick do this before. Yeah. Have a great start to the season and then sort of get round or two in and be nowhere. Well, and
he just goes missing every now and again, doesn't he?
Yeah, he goes walkies a bit. Like, I don't.
Because when he wins a race like he does in the first one in Qatar, you just think, well, he's got everything a MotoGP rider, world champion needs.
And that was, like, I think, and Qatar this year was probably his best win ever.
Yeah.
In GP,
so dominant. Yeah.
But
you can't be up and down like that.
No. No,
can't just go missing.
No, and I think he got a couple of points today, but it's not good enough from a factory Yamaha rider, and especially when your teammate's winning. Yes, you can say that his qualifying, he should have been on the front row. I think he should have been second if his lap had stuck. But
that would have helped a Yamaha as well.
Yeah, exactly. But shit happens in racing, and unfortunately, you know, you've got to swallow that, and then. On the grid, he's then going, what rear tire? And he can see people around him and going on hards, and Morbidelli went on the hard and he's gone, right, I'm going to go on the hard or something. And he's based his own decision off somebody else's. And if you're lacking a bit of, you know, I don't know what to do, just go with what you do. If you've done all your running in free practices on medium, go on the medium. And
it's like it's a bit of self-confidence issue.
Yeah.
A stressful moment or something.
I think a lot of people just want to grab Mav and sort of go, just believe in yourself because you're a top rider.
Yeah.
And if you just believe in what you do, you're going to be absolutely fine. And it went pear-shaped for him again today. And I don't like to see it because I think he's fantastic on his day. Yeah. It's just he has certain days of the week, unfortunately.
So after Quartararo, who did this quite stunning job on the podium, we had Mir.
Francesco Bagnaia.
And Bagnaia. Yeah. Yeah. So Bagnaia is a guy we have to talk about. Obviously, he put it on pole without the yellow flag infringement by 0.4, which really was his pole. Don't get me wrong, I feel the same. And the yellow flag situation is the yellow flag situation. But he's the only guy that kept it together on the Ducati, which seems pretty difficult to ride, and brought it through in a very calm manner for a young lad.
He's the man who's causing Jet Miller a lot of headaches at the minute, I think. Those two were teammates from last year. But I think it's sort of like a secret or something said on a lowdown, but I think from stuff that you hear on stuff like BT Sport. And I think the consensus is that that's really Ducati's man in Francesco Bagnaia. It's always funny that, isn't it? But I think he's the real deal through Moto3, Moto2, absolutely fantastic on a bike, Moto2 world champion. So solid, consistent through the race, to come from 11th on the grid to second, Was it second?
Yeah, he was second. Yeah,
yeah, he was second. It was, you know, that's a real mature ride on a bike that's difficult around a track like that. You know, got great one lap pace as we saw in Qatar, but the race pace is a little bit more difficult for him. So really mature ride, really good ride, and, you know, resisting the pressure of Mir from behind.
He seems to do, I mean, I'm watching again as a complete bike rookie, but the way he adjusts himself in particular corners when it's getting more difficult, because he used his tire quite a lot, I feel, to get past some guys. But he knows, he's, you can see him, say, turning into the downhill left, which is turn five, I think. Downhill left, where Rins went off.
Yeah, five, yeah.
Yeah. And you can see him, and he's turning in a bit, and he just knows the exact point to when to go, no, I just need to lift it a bit. And he doesn't mind if he misses that apex by an extra 20, 30 centimeters. He's happy just to okay, I'll be a tenth or two, I'll lose a tenth, but I'm just not going to hit the deck. And he did a lot of adjustments through the race. Even in the last corner, for example, where he just do ever so slightly, say, lift himself up just to not just make
touch,
that.
Yeah, just touch big, that limit and then go slightly wide, you know. But it, but it's
adapt.
Not, but it's not even like a touch the limit and then push wide. It's a touch the, go just to the limit and then pick, no, that's too close, and then back in.
Yeah.
That's feeling.
Such a little movement, and it was him and Quartararo that were quite noticeable.
You can't teach that. That's just pure feeling. I think a lot of the guys out there have it, but, you know, like Quartararo on the Yamaha. But I think with that style of bike, like the Yamaha, it's easier to do it than say, I think Zarco can do it, and Miller can do it, and Bagnaia and Martin and whatever Ducati rider you want. But I think on that bike, it's a little bit more difficult to.
A bit more peaky in terms of when it goes, it really goes.
Yeah. So I think like Zarco's today, you know, you've got a big wallow on and it's just gone what, and then gone.
And it's done what?
It's gone what?
And then gone. These motorsport hand signals are getting out of hand now.
And then...
like in the nightclub.
Yeah. That's for June 21st, that is. Yeah, it's, you know, Rossi had the just tuck.
Yeah.
And Zarco had the wop. So,
tuck a wop. It's a new dance move 2021.
Yeah.
you've heard
it here first, but Jake, I'm not sure how much of the race you saw, but I'm going to ask you the same question, boys. Who were your winners and losers from MotoGP today? Go on, I'll start with Nick again.
Okay, well,
I think there's only one winner today.
And it's Marc Marquez, though, in my opinion. And it's actually, he's not even the winner. It's we're the winners to have him back, because it just makes everything so much more exciting, in my opinion, because it's one of those guys that you, a bit like a Hamilton, you just don't get them very often at this level. And to do what he did today, both physically and mentally, to come back after 9 months, you know, 9 months of not racing, sitting on the sidelines, painstakingly waiting for his opportunity. And then he does that. Start from where, sixth or seventh on the grid, straight into third, and he was like, he almost, you could sense it in his riding. He was almost like, oh shit, I didn't really want to be here, but naturally he got there.
But we're gonna go for it now.
Exactly. So for me, it would be him all day, and the loser, I'll go straight into that. I think was Jack Miller. I think it was maybe a slightly stoppy error. Yes, it spat him off very fast, but if you look at what his teammate did. It showed if he was just maybe a bit more patient and used that Ducati power down the straights, it could have been a whole different story.
Yeah, I generally have to agree with that. I think one of the biggest losers for the sport at the minute is Valentino.
Yeah, that's going to be my loser.
I just...
Sad, yeah.
Is this the end? I think that's the question.
That's another video.
That's another video.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to get a fast, you know, a better bike than what he's on now, is he? I know that he's gone from factory down to satellite. He's not going to get back into a factory bike now.
His
so.
Teammates drilling him.
Yeah, and shout out to Franco. I'll touch on it very quickly. He's not happy. Not happy at all. He's said in the Italian press that the situation is quite irritating, being he's on the 2019 bike. I think Rossi's on a more factory spec bike, and Quartararo and Vinales on the new chassis and everything. Considering Morbidelli was top Yamaha last year and finished second in the World Championship. Yeah. So there's big rumours around Morbidelli and what's going to happen in the future there. But that is for another video, as we've said. And the time
video's coming up then.
And the timer now says 1 hour and 9 minutes. So we're going to wrap it up there.
time for bed, our kids. I've got busy day tomorrow. So, yeah, thank you, as always, for everyone listening and whatnot. We want to know as well who your favourites were. And also, we want to know who you think was more to blame in the Bottas Russell situation. So get in the comments, like and subscribe, and we will see you all in the next one.
Catch you later, guys.
Cheers, guys. Cheers.